also just want to say thank you to everybody who was on a panel and everybody who came and spoke at this whole thing. So I've never heard Tarik share before. So when we like took this conference on, there was like a bunch of people that were like super fired up, and everybody went to Florida and had all these big plans, and like everybody had everything together. And that literally has dwindled down to like three people. but Ryan, like he is like an avid speaker tape, like listening to everybody, and he loves listening to speakers. So I trusted and knew that everybody that he asked to speak here would be awesome. So I'm excited to hear Tarik because I know it's going to be great. Thank you guys.
My name is Tarik. I'm an addict. And I am full. I don't mean from food. It's been an amazing weekend. The messages were all grounded in sincerity, which I think is a requirement for the spiritual basis of life. You know, there are a lot of events maybe going on around this country right now. And most people that get together for a weekend event, they gather based on their strengths. You know, you got these events for doctors and psychologists and different types of professional people. I can't think of another society that gathers based on our limitations and our brokenness. And that's a beautiful thing. It's one ingredient in the cement that binds us. And that cement's a magical combination of problem and solution. But there's something that happens in my healing as I integrate into a complete human being when I hear the accounts and the testimonies of others, and it is based on them sharing their brokenness with me. And that's what I feel like I was experiencing this weekend. There was such an authentic undertone to all the shares this weekend. And David, yours is the only one that made me nervous to follow you this morning, because I've known David for many, many years. And I experienced him as grounded for the first time in all those years this weekend, and that just opened up my heart to see you like that and witness that. I have been properly armed with facts about myself as a result of putting into practical application the process outlined in our big book. I can generally win the entire confidence of an alcoholic pretty quick, heroin addicts a little longer, but I speak crackhead language, all right? I'm a crackhead. Crack cocaine, when the big book says pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I only robbed, cheated, stole, torched relationships for crack cocaine. I did a lot of dope, smoked a lot of meth, had a very, very expensive OxyContin habit. But when the big book says pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, it was crack cocaine for me. Right? But the big book also says that I can win that confidence when I sit down and share my experience. And until that is accomplished, little or nothing can be done. And that's identification. So I know I'm going to devote the majority of my time this morning to sharing my experience with steps 10, 11, and 12. But I got to tell you how God brought me back from the gates of insanity and almost death to tell this story. I had the sexual abuse at the hands of a family member. I had abandonment issues. Two little boys, mom has alcoholic husband. Alcoholic husband's very violent, abusive, physically, emotionally, verbally. She does not have the capacity. So when he's on a drunk and my brother and I are 5, 6, 7 years old, she slaps her face, she pulls her hair, she packs her bags, and she says, "I'm leaving and I'm never coming back." These two little boys sit in the dining room table looking out the window, and they watch every headlight go by all night. Sometimes I get sick to my stomach, I get diarrhea, I'd start vomiting. That was a psychological wounding that gave birth to the idea that I was inadequate in some way. All right. What was born was a story. I'm not important. So how do I solve that? I need to be important. I need to have your approval in order to be okay. That was my first addiction, was approval. And I've heard that several times over the course of the weekend. Identification for the ego is vitally important, and where I identified was athletics and academics. I was smart, I was articulate, I was teacher's pet, everybody loved me, I made good grades, I was an all-county basketball player, I played all year round, AAU, played basketball my first year in college, these ego identities that I developed, they kept me safe and protected in those first few years because I was a periodic drinker and I saw the earmarks of loss of control with alcohol. And I'm not going deep into my story here. Something happened in 1995. The Grateful Dead, widespread panic, and fish came into my life. All right. And that was a severe turn there. I was 18 years old. I went to my first panic show, and I discovered an alternate reality. I discovered an underground culture. I discovered a group of people whose sole objective for the evening was to put this magical cocktail of drugs into your system and alcohol and be free from the bondage of self. Now, I only can use that terminology to describe it in hindsight. After being exposed to this program and looking back and analyzing, right, and interpreting my life experiences, am I able to say that's what I was looking for? I wanted to be free from my mind. And for those 3 hours in that experience, I was free from my mind. I had no past. I had no future. I was entirely present. I was present. But it took years of work to see that. And I went to college. I got some great jobs after college, but I also learned that I could go to all these shows for free if I sold drugs in the parking lot before the show. I would get the money I needed for that show. I always had girls around because girls like guys that had a lot of drugs in their pockets, and I had money for the next show, and I would just go. I would follow the band, you know, across the country, 38 states. That's what I did, and I still managed to get some pretty good jobs. And I managed to lose every one of those jobs because of my relationship with crack cocaine. And then I was arrested on the evening of November 5th, or November 4th. So a power greater than myself separated me from crack cocaine and whiskey on the morning of November 5th. But what happened was you know, God had been in my life all along in different manifestations. And that particular evening, he manifested himself as some Duval County police officers. And he separated me. And we experienced two miracles in this program. The first miracle has to happen quickly, and that's the miracle of separation. If that had not happened, there'd be no recovery to talk about. And that's a quick miracle. The other one is a little bit slower in evolution, which is the returning sanity. You know, and for many of us, that sanity, when the big book talks in the 10th step about being placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected, I'm not fighting it, I'm not avoiding it. I feel like I have been placed in a position of neutrality. That is the illusion that I ever had a choice. Right? That's been removed from me because that's what I struggled with all those years. I wanted to be the weekend warrior, not understanding that I had friends who the effect produced in them was quite different, and it was even different when it came to drugs like crack cocaine, believe it or not. And on that evening, I was arrested, and I had a drug trafficking charge, and I had an intent to distribute charge. And so what I tried to do in that first section of my talk was give you a little bit to identify on, to tell you, you know, what I was like. I believe the most misquoted passage or phrase in our big book is what I was like, what happened, and what I am like now. What I hear it referred to is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But it leaves it open to interpretation. I can sit up here and tell you my story from the state of emotional conditioning that I had throughout the years, my relationships, financial well-being, my relationship with drugs and alcohol. But to me, it's about character. The spiritual path is about the refinement of character as we stay here and we live the spiritual basis of life. The friction and the burning that my grosser handicaps and my limitations create, that's what hones and polishes my character. And I can't remember who used that analogy this weekend. I think it was Adam last night about the Michelangelo and the Statue of David. And Michelangelo wasn't, you know, chipping away to create David. He just chipped away what he knew it wasn't. And he sat and stared at it for a very long time, trying to understand what didn't need to be there. And the struggles I go through on a day-to-day basis with my character and those shortcomings, and that's what chips away at Tarek. My problem is God's chipping over here, and I'm like, no, dude, you need to chip over here. And I always think I have some illusion of control, and that's not true. And that evening, I was separated, and I stayed up all night. I had woken up on October 30th. I'd gone to see Panic in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I had not slept yet, and it's the evening of November 4th, just to give you an idea. At that point in my story, it was a lot of Oxycontin, a lot of crack, a lot of DMT, and a lot of alcohol. So I was not in my right state of mind, not even close. I had no business being out in public, but for some reason I thought I was invincible. And I was arrested. And I stayed up all night that first night. And now granted, the experience I'm about to describe is a spiritual experience while being intoxicated. Because wouldn't that limit the power of God if he only worked through sober people? I don't believe that to be true. Sitting on the edge of my cot, looking out the strip, I don't even call it a window. And the sun was coming up, and there was a thought injected into my consciousness. Well, and the reason I phrase it that way, I wasn't having a train of successive thoughts that culminated into this next thought. What was injected into my consciousness was the thought that my new sobriety date was Jason's birthday. Now, here's why that's important. In 2003, on October 12th, I lost one of my best friends to a drug overdose on my birthday. I sit in that county jail, sitting on the edge of that cot, looking out that strip, and that's injected into my consciousness. The universe, God, creative intelligence, whatever you want to call it, that's underlying the totality of all things, was communicating with me. And I did not discount it. Because for the first time, the voice that lies to us on a continual basis, we all have 7 or 8 voices that talk to, in my experience, let me stick to myself, I have 7 or 8 different voices that communicate with me in my consciousness. And then there is a witness to all of that that's going on in my consciousness. There's one specific voice that's there to wreck me, and that's the I call it the voice of the liar. And it's the one where I was in treatment, all those trips to treatment and sober living and IOPs that said that I'm a little bit different from these people. This is my plan and my design to get myself out of this. This is who I'm going to manipulate. This is what I need to do to get what I want. That voice was always prevalent, but it was not. It had gone into remission on that morning. And I took it resonated deeply and landed deeply within me. I stayed in that county jail for 5 weeks. This was an inner city jail. It was extremely difficult for me to leave my cell and get my food tray every day. Dangerous. Someone died while I was in there. So I started going to Bible study because I saw that nobody messed with all the guys walking over to that end of the pod to go to Bible study. And I would sit there and listen to these guys that had gotten jailhouse religion. It's what it was. Call it what it is. But they were talking in terminology that I heard the good people of AA and CA at that time talk about. They were talking about making amends. They were talking about service to others. They were talking about forgiveness. And all that was being communicated with me was, I need to go back to the 12 steps. And so I continued this 5 weeks, and they passed books around the pod. I read 2 books. One was called Live Your Best Life Now. The other book was called Exceeding Gratitude for the Creator. I'm reading these books, and I'm being pulled back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm being pulled back to the 12-step fellowships. And then as I'm sitting there, this man keeps popping in my head. And this man was the old-timer that sat in the back of the room on Friday night, this massive meeting I used to go to, very, very strong meeting. He was what I called the closer, right? Every Friday night, he's going to be the last guy that got called on, you know, because he was one of the founding members of that group. And this old man used to say things like this: if you're new in this program, we suggest that you do not share. You have nothing that we want. We suggest that you sign up for a big book study, that you get a sponsor, that you work some steps, that you make some amends, that you learn how to practice step 10 and 11, and then we're gonna be interested in hearing what you have to share with us about the 12th step. And I remember we used to go outside of that Friday night group, and we would talk shit about this man. And here he is popping in my head in Duval County Jail. And I'm like, what is going on? Why do I keep thinking of this man named Dante? And so this next piece that I'm going to describe as I walk into steps 10 and 11 and 12 is the what happened. A lot of people would maybe assume the what happened was getting arrested. What happened was could have been sitting on the edge of the cot. But I was the type of addict that disappeared. So mom would not know where her son was for a very long time. And I had not had much communication with my mom during that period of time in my life. And one of the guys that used to sell drugs with me, he had gotten me a lawyer. And that lawyer came to my arraignment. And the best thing my family ever did for me was not answer my phone calls. They would pick up the phone, but they said I needed to be in jail. My brother said, you need to stay there. My best friend said, you need to stay there. I go to the arraignment. I said, hey, my lawyer's name was Travis. I said, hey, Travis, have you spoken to my mother? He goes, yeah, she's right there in the gallery. And so now this is when there's some, my vision is distorted. It's like time-lapse photography. And I turn and everything's real blurry. And it's like this tunnel of light between my mother and I. And I witness what selfish and inconsiderate habits do to other people. Remember, when we get to the fifth step in the big book, it doesn't say drugs and alcohol kept the home in turmoil. It says selfish and inconsiderate habits kept the home in turmoil. And that's what I saw. I saw a woman who almost collapsed in the courtroom. Her eyes were sunken in her head. She had lost a tremendous amount of weight, and she looked very fragile. And in that moment, I was split wide open. In that moment, something died in me. And from that scrap heap, I was going to be raised to a level of life that I had never known. But something had to die in that moment. And what was dying was the idea that I could do anything to solve the problem that I was confronted with. And what was born was unacceptance. We hear about acceptance all the time, and acceptance is the answer to some of our problems some of the time. When you're trying to change something, just accepting it is going to make it worse. And for the first time in my life, to be capable and have the capacity to do what I was doing to the people that loved me was unacceptable. And when things become unacceptable, you become willing to take a course of action you've never been willing to take before. And that was the birth. Big Book talks about it in our third step. I will be reborn. All right, if I keep him close and perform his work. Not that that was going on with me in that moment, but this idea of unacceptance, I carry it to this day. It saved my life because I was a meeting-making fool for 3 years. 2004 is when I went to my first step, 12-step meeting. I listened to Stick with the Winners. I listened to Don't Leave Before the Miracle Happens. I listened to Keep Coming Back because it works if you work it. And these slogans, by the grace of God, work if they would just tack on behind them, by the grace of God. Just don't drink no matter what, by the grace of God. But using that as somehow of a tool to practice, hints of self-reliance for me. And that's not what this program is about. And so they let me out several weeks later. I ended up spending a total of 5 weeks, and I needed to go to this treatment center, 90 days inpatient, and I need to find the guy that I was kept popping in my head, this man, Dante. I need to find him. He's at that Friday night meeting. So I got the treatment center to carry us down 35 minutes south of the treatment center to go to this Friday night meeting in hopes of finding this man who was popping up in my mind. And I get to that meeting, and it's late. It's a Friday night. We pull in the druggy buggy. We get out. I beeline it to the church. There's one man standing outside on his cell phone, and it's one of that guy's sponsees. His name was Randy. I walked up to that man, and I just wanted to be connected to the man. And that guy started working with me, and he met with me once a week, and we covered one chapter in the book starting from the title page, really the blank page, and we worked all the way through. We did the third step in a closet in the basement of that treatment center, and then I started making amends, and I had this court case, and my lawyer worked out a deal for 3 years in prison. And I said to myself, what am I going to do? I would go to Randy, and by this time, Dante, the man, had become my sponsor. I had gone to him. I just gravitated towards him. He would be my sponsor for the next year and a half. And they would tell me things like, read the prayer on page 68. When you're afraid about what's going to happen to you in prison, ask God to remove the fear and direct your attention to what he would have you be. I didn't like that advice. Rarely did I enjoy that advice. The other thing they loved to tell me was there was going to be somebody in prison to carry the message to. But they said, they guaranteed me something. They said, Tarek, we don't know what's going to happen to you if you keep making these amends and you continue to practice steps 10, 11, and 12, but we can tell you what's going to happen to you if you don't. And I believed that. And my case kept getting continued. I got back into school. I'd been kicked out of graduate school back in 2002. So I got back into graduate school because it wasn't a living amends to my parents, but I wanted to give my parents a gift. You know, my parents have always been the type of people that like other people to know how their kids are doing. And I knew my parents would be happy if I could say I got a master's degree. So I got back into grad school. I got my own apartment. I started working at the treatment center. I got a second job, and I documented all of this. And my case kept getting continued. Then on August 5th, 2008, I get a phone call from my attorney, who has gone now through three different assistant district attorneys. Three different judges have been assigned to this case. I don't know why it unfolded like this other than the power of God. He calls me that morning, and this is what he says to me. He's like, Tarek, I do not understand what just happened, but somebody upstairs truly does love you because they just dismissed all the charges. They dismissed all the charges. I didn't have to roll on anybody. I didn't have to become a narc. The two Schedule I felonies in the state of Florida vanished. I made a declaration and a commitment to my Creator. It was almost like I took another third step in my apartment, my little studio apartment that morning, that I was going to live the way of life described in that big book to the best of my ability from that moment until whatever God is rips this spirit or this soul from this body. And that's what I have done for almost 14 years. It didn't make any sense to me. It's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about this program and what's possible. And you got to have belief or nothing's possible. So I struggle when I get to the second step with some guys because I know we want to focus on a willingness to believe, but I'm not that type of sponsor. I'm going to push them to believe because the possibility is stronger the closer we are to belief. And so the tenth, as we go through these step process, so what I wanted to describe to you is what I was like, what happened. And then there's an evolution that takes place because the first time I spoke from a podium was 9 months sober. And my knowledge far exceeded my experience at that point. I got up here and I was like, what am I going to talk about for 50 minutes? The first time I spoke at an event like this was in 2012. Same thing happened. What am I going to talk about for 45 minutes or 50 minutes? I'm going to tell you right now, that's not enough time for me to share what I want to share. I can talk about steps 10, 11, and 12 for an entire day. I have before. I love the entire program. But here's the deal with steps 10 and 11. There is practicing step 10 and 11 when you have unfinished amends. And then there's practicing 10 and 11 with all your amends completed. It's a night and day, stark contrast to the two. I got sober. I had over 200 amends, people in institutions. It took me 8.5 years to approach all those individuals. It was 230. Of those 230, about 40 never responded to my approach. About another 30 didn't have full names, so I had to write letters. I heard a lot of women. I wrote a bunch of letters. I found a female in the program, and I read all those letters. The other ones, I found a man in the program, and I read those letters to him. A bunch of those were deceased as well. That left me about 160 individuals. Of those 160, about 30 of them said, you're a piece of shit. I never want to see you again. I acknowledged my willingness to sit down with them and clean up the harm that I had created. Would they be willing to do that? We don't get free in the ninth step. We get free in the eighth step. The people we harm get free in the ninth step. And then I sat down with the remainder face to face. I just recently made a financial amends that's now brought me to $25,000 that I've paid back over 13 and a half years. I still have financial amends to make. I have nothing that can pull me from the past out of the present. What pulls me out of the present is the future these days, not the past. There's not one street on this planet that I can walk down and see someone else walking towards me and it's going to change my behavior or what I think about myself or my interaction with another human being. It's just not possible because I have confronted all of the individuals that I could to express my willingness to make things right. And I got free in that process. Now we walk into steps 10 and 11. Well, the first nine steps are the launching pad into the world of the spirit. The world of the spirit has a totally different language. It's called the language of the heart. And it's language that I do not know when I arrive at steps 10 and 11. When I arrived at step 10 the first time, I was taken under the wing of a bunch of Joe and Charlie guys. They were amazing. They spoon-fed me the program of recovery by modeling it to me. They taught me the meeting before the meeting, and the meeting after the meeting. I will never forget the first time Dante, one of my heroes to this day, one of the most important men in my life, Dante said, meet me at the church at 5:30. It's an 8 o'clock meeting. I was like, 5:30? He's like, meet me at 5:30. So I get there. And we talk for a few minutes, and then we walk into the auditorium. It's a big meeting. And he walks over to this storage closet, opens it up, and there's stacks and stacks and stacks of chairs. And he goes, I need you to pull all those stacks. They're on rollers. Roll them out and strategically put them throughout the auditorium. There'll be some people here in a little bit to help you put out all the chairs. I got a big book study upstairs I'm going to go do. He leaves me down there. So I'm like, okay. So I go and I unload all those rollers. I put the chairs out. Two guys show up. We end up setting up the meeting. He comes down from his big book study. By this time, it's like 7 o'clock. And he's like, yeah, this looks good. He helps us finish off the rest of the chairs. He goes outside and he just hangs out front, and people start showing up and he's greeting everybody. The treatment center vans start coming and he's introducing himself to everybody. Then the meeting starts. We have the meeting. Later, after I started sponsoring people during the Lord's Prayer, I'd be sitting next to him and he would lean over and he'd say, hey, that guy raised his hand. He's looking for a sponsor. As soon as this Lord's Prayer is over, you beeline it over there and you talk to him. That's the 12-step fellowship that I grew up in. After the meeting, we helped break down the meeting. He was in charge of it. He was there. He didn't click up with all his friends and start talking. He was breaking down the meeting. Then he locked up the church and he said, come on, we're going to Longhorn. Friday night, that was my schedule for the first 3 years of my sobriety. I started meeting my sponsees at the church at 5:30. I would do step work with them. I'd take them downstairs to help me set up the meeting. And so the story about the mop was that touched me, because I knew exactly what that experience was like later on when I would hand off that job. I didn't have a service position at that group for the first 2 years, but that was, everybody knew that was Tarek's job, was setting up the meeting. And I'm forever grateful for the men that modeled this program to me. The 10th step was steps 4 through 9, or a spot check inventory, or assets versus liabilities inventory. There's no downside to any of that. But the 10th step in the big book's worded interestingly. It says this thought, what thought? Making amends. That's why I wanted to talk about making amends. This thought brings us to step 10, which is that we continue to take personal inventory and we're wrong, promptly admitted it. Unfortunately, when I go to a lot of meetings about step 10, usually it's focused on, you know, apologizing or discussing with other people. We discuss it with immediately. That's just some of the instructions that are in this 10th step. It says that we continue to take personal inventory as we go along. We watch. I like the word witness. I like to witness. I like to become the guardian of my inner space. So this weekend, I had to practice a 10th step as I sat there. And because I wanted to be present to all the speakers. But my mind, you know, somebody would share something that maybe I might reference from the podium. And like this, the egoic part of me was like, oh, you can't talk about that this weekend. It's already been touched on, right? And so I would have to, I'd witness this about myself. And then I'd have to take a deep breath. God, remove this from my mind and bring me present. Over and over. I probably said that prayer 100 times this weekend sitting in that chair. Because my reliance has been to turn to God, right? Because one of the next steps, we watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When they crop up, they're always going to crop up. We ask God at once to remove them. Not that he's going to remove them, but what it's trying to teach us is relying on the power, the relationship that we have with this regenerative power. Look what it's done to all the people sitting in this room in this morning. It has regenerated you. That is a marvelous, powerful idea to grab a hold of. And so as we evolve, you know, when I showed up here, I was very much self-survival. I was power-driven by my willingness to do whatever I had to do, not to have a glass pipe in my mouth ever again. You know, I was instinctive, and it was about survival. Then somewhere along the way, as I stayed on the spiritual basis of life long enough, there became this presence that I didn't have much experience with. It's called a conscience. I call it the blaming sense of self. And I don't mean sense of blame from like a neurotic place. I mean a sense of blame from conscientiousness. My troubles are all of my own making. They arise out of myself, and I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot. When I begin to live life with that knowledge, I begin to have this default position, which is like, oh, I'm in trouble. How did I get myself in this situation? That became the default. It was no longer a sense of blaming others. The blame was always here. Right. And then along the way, it transforms into something else, and it's almost like an inspired sense of self. If you practice step 10 and 11 and you devote yourself to meditation and prayer, you'll begin to have the vital sixth sense that the big book talks about in step 10, which is God consciousness. The interesting thing about God consciousness is later in the book, in the spiritual experience appendix, which I read with the guys I sponsor two times because there's two asterisks that reference the spiritual experience appendix. And there's descriptions of the word change, but what they're really saying is you don't have to have this powerful white light experience. It can come over time. But that's not even what I want to talk to you about. One of the most powerful sentences in our big books is actually on when you turn the page. It says, most of our members believe that the essence, the word essence, what makes everybody God in this room tonight is that the essence of God anchors each individual in this room in existence right now. The essence of God. This makes God immanent, meaning it's present right now. And God is also transcendent beyond our definition and comprehension, but it has to be both. And when I see that word essence, the essence of the spiritual experience is simply the awareness of a power greater than ourselves. What that translates into for me is I got to think about God as often as possible. I must remember God as often as possible. And that's what the 10th step comes into play about, is really remembrance of God. How do I do this? I have to observe myself. I have to become a guardian of my inner space. And when that happens, and I'm using prayer, like in the 12 and 12, Bill says something very important. He says that prayer and meditation, while used alone or together, are exceptional. When you do self-examination, prayer and meditation, something phenomenal happens. And that's what the 10th step is about for me. It's about prayer as I'm moving through the day. It's about, if you're practicing remembering God, and maybe in your breath is another 10th step exercise that I share with the men I sponsor. That's a form of meditation. Anything that's trying to focus my awareness is a form of meditation. And then the constant self-reflection. And that's one of the gifts that I've been given as a result of this program, is like I want to reflect on the interactions with humans. So my spiritual condition, like the 10th step talks about that. We have a daily stay of execution. A daily stay of execution contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. The spiritual condition is the only reason people relapse. I think I've heard that this weekend is all. There's no other reason. It's all about spiritual condition. But for me, for those first 3 years, it was about getting my credit card back. It was about getting a car back. It was about getting a female back. It was about something other than spiritual condition. So therefore, I would always run out of gas at some point in the 12 steps. But for whatever reason, what's been traveling with me since that experience in Duval County Jail, and I don't know where I got, this is a complete gift. And you know, gifts have to be received. I can't give myself a gift. I guess some people give themselves gifts, but I don't give myself gifts. But what was given to me as a gift was curiosity about the spiritual realm. And so when the big book says we've entered the world of the spirit, so the first 9 steps are the launching pad. Well, what is the world of the spirit? If you want to have some fun at your home group when you go home and you're a topic leader, bring that up. I'd like everyone to talk about their experience since they've entered the world of the Spirit, and what is that? What does that look like? Because if you practice the steps 10 and 11 on a consistent basis of watching, asking, turning. Now, the big book says we turn our thoughts to someone and we can help. What's that evolved into over the years for me is I turn my attention back to God. And for me, it's my breath. I believe that God is breathing through me, that God is witnessing his existence through all of us. He created all of us to experience himself or herself or itself. And when I can bring back that knowledge into the moment, it changes my orientation with existence. It changes my orientation with you and how I interact with you. This is an extremely difficult practice. The 10 steps, by far, the hardest step to practice in our big book. Because it follows up with a code of love and tolerance that I must practice. And then it says, stop fighting. All suffering is resistance to what is happening in front of you in the present moment. This is a tenth step. This is an active tenth step that it must occur as we walk through the day. And so I look at the steps 10 and 11. So when I wake up in the morning, it's step 11. I wake up at 4:30 Monday through Friday. And I am excited to go and spend time in my space that I've created for my practices. I have had this daily practice for many years. The thing is, the daily practice falls off from time to time, and I have complete faith that it's going to return every single time. I don't freak out. You know, I'll go on vacation sometimes, and I won't pray and meditate for 3 or 4 days, but throughout the course of the day, my attention and my awareness is drawn to the presence of God in my life. Now, I think that's sort of like the analogy I heard this week about going to the gym and working out. I've done the workouts. I've been doing this work for a very long time. As a result, I've gained experience. And I will continue to do this work because I am curious about the spiritual realm. The greatest two gifts I've received here are willingness and curiosity. Because I can't ever get bored with God. I know less about God than I did when I got here, far less. I'm going to know less about God next year than I do now. And that's okay with me. Because as long as I don't know, I'm going to investigate. And that's what's important when it comes to these two steps, is your willingness to investigate the spiritual dimensions of steps 10 and 11. And then it says there's an attitude that's required. Several speakers this weekend reference this attitude on page 55. Lay aside prejudice, think honestly, and search diligently within yourself. You can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. In step 11, it says, better men than us have been using these practices with the right attitude. That's that same attitude when it comes to prayer and meditation. Lay aside the prejudice, think honestly, and search diligently within yourself. That's what I was instructed to do. And as a result, I found the great reality deep down within, that fundamental idea that's deep down within every man, woman, and child. In the last analysis, the last place we look is inside. We're going to look everywhere else except inside, and that's where we look. That's why they say in the last analysis. So the 11th step, well, how do I take this idea of prayer and meditation? So meditation, I'm going to tell you a funny story. So the first sponsor I had didn't stress meditation. Second sponsor I had didn't stress meditation. I have about 9 months. Those were the first 2 years. I have about 9 months clean and sober, and I'm at a clubhouse in Atlanta, and there's this guy, Nari. Nari's soul, like one of his favorite things to do is stand outside this clubhouse with it. This was back when we had you burn CDs. I think all of us in here remember what burn CDs were like. He'd have the stack of CDs, and he'd hand them out. He'd hand out this talk by this guy with this one eye. He's got a patch over his eye. His name is Chris. He'd hand out one of his CDs. It was called The Spiritual Malady. And then he handed out another CD by this guy named Mark Houston, who's passed away. And it was called Hollow Bone. I took these CDs when I had 9 months sober from Nari. And I got to my car and I put them in my door. Didn't listen to them. Fast forward a year and a half, clean and sober. I am miserable. I'm sponsoring 6 or 7 guys. My sex life is upside down. Like I'm harming a lot of women in the program. I don't like sitting by myself. When I'm at home at this time, I've got my computer on, I've got music on, the TV is on, and I'm trying to call someone in the fellowship because I cannot experience myself. I cannot be in solitude. And so this is what was going on. So one night I'm driving home from the meeting and I am like, "This, there's got to be more than this. This is bullshit. I am sponsoring a bunch of guys. My ego's all wrapped up in it. I think I'm important. What is going on?" And this thought is injected into my consciousness. Get one of those CDs. So I put in this CD. It's Mark H. And he starts the CD off with this: "I love meetings that start with meditation. They bring me here now because that's all there really is." And then he proceeded to break down steps 10 and 11 that made this big book enthusiast wonder what the hell book this guy was reading, because that's not the way I was brought into steps 10 and 11. And so I went around Atlanta looking for somebody who knew this guy. I didn't even know there was such a thing as speaker CDs at the time. I didn't. Just did not. I was not made aware. You know, at that point, I don't even remember if I knew there was such thing as recovery conventions. And so I'm at the Longhorn dinner after Friday night, and everybody's gone. It's just me and my buddy Mike sitting across from each other, and I'm telling him about this guy on this CD that is talking about recovery in a way I've never, if I did hear it, I did not listen. And Mike's grinning. He's got this grin on his face. I'm like, "What are you laughing about?" He's like, "Dude, that's my grand sponsor." And my eyes lit up. I was like, "Who's your sponsor?" He's like, "This cat named Scott." I was like, "Introduce me to Scott." And Scott was my sponsor for the next 7.5 years. And then we had a difference of opinion about some things, and I needed a new sponsor. And I've always been involved, not always, since 2012. I participate in conventions like this on a regular basis. I put on a retreat, and I host speakers in Atlanta because my home groups in Atlanta always traveled speakers in from all over the country. And this one weekend, I was hosting a man named Ralph. And this was in January of 2017. And my ex-wife at the time, I owned a recovery center, and she was the HR director at the largest brewery in Atlanta called Sweetwater. And when I tell you we became the proverbial two ships passing in the night, that would be an understatement. Her life was about social life and partying, and it was okay. My life was about trying to help drug addicts and alcoholics, and it just the fabric of our relationship began to dissolve, and her drinking was escalating. And I tried to have a female in the program, 12-step her. She did not like that. And then this weekend, I'm hosting Ralph, and she has a blackout episode. And when she blacked out, she got catatonic, and her eyes glazed over, and complete psychic change, personality change, and we've ended up in a lot of arguments, right? It's funny how you forget powerlessness and how it applies when it's someone really close to you, because you think they got a choice in the matter for some reason, but we know they don't. But I can't see it sometimes. I need to get out of the situation to look at it. And Ralph held my hand that weekend. Man, I saw a man with so much grace and dignity, and he was so gentle, and he instructed me on what to do. And my dad was dying at the time. And I got to talk about this because this is part of the 10th step as well. And this is how I'm going to talk about sponsors, is the way they, you know, I know the 12 steps is about me carrying the message. I also like to share with you the men that have influenced me in my life as part of their 12th step. And Ralph, he held my hand through that process. And my dad was dying at the same time. And Ralph would leave town. And 3 weeks later, my wife would tell me that the marriage was over, that I needed to move out. So my marriage fell apart. I was living out of a bag. So in my eyes, I had no home. So I had no anchor. So I became homeless to a degree. And I was the primary caretaker of my father. Now, what's important about my father? My father was that abusive man I mentioned at the beginning of my story. He was the raging alcoholic. He was the man whose ass I whooped when I was in high school because he was beating on my mom. Me and my brother kicked his ass several times, like close fist. At 16, I decided I didn't want my dad in my life. And from the age of 16 until I got clean, my dad was not in my life. But then something happened in that first fist step. I had 16, 17 resentments towards my dad. Forgot my birthday, never came to a basketball game. He was abusive to my mom. He was abusive to my grandmother. If he had been a better father, I would not have been an addict. My brother would have his shit together. You know, he's made my mom suffer. It went on and on. And so Randy was the man that listened to my first fifth step. He would sit there and he'd say, okay, scan your life right now. Who have you done that to? And he exposed my hypocrisy and every resentment that I had towards my father. Over and over and over until 3/4 of the way through, my head drops. I look up at Randy. I am my father. He's like, yes, you are. And for the first time, compassion was born. And I went to make amends to my father. My mom's divorced my father by this point. He's in this apartment by himself. Doesn't drink when I'm around, but he's drinking himself to death. And I make this amends with my father, and I ask him what I can do to make it right. He says two things to me. Please spend time with me and be happy. I took my dad to lunch on Sundays in a movie almost every Sunday until he passed away or until he got sick. I learned so much from that man about unconditional love. After everything me and my brother had put him through, he still loved us. He still loved us. And when he was diagnosed with cancer in 2016, I was his primary caretaker. Me and my brother had now become estranged. My brother is also struggled from time to time with this thing, although I don't think he has it. I think he would qualify as a hard drug user. And my dad, I took my dad to chemo every Friday for 4 weeks in a row. Then we'd take 2 weeks off. Then was back to chemo. It was grueling. And it's interesting when you spend that much time surrounded by people who are in like they're literally staring death in the face. You know, alcoholics and addicts are interesting. We all think we're going to win the lottery, and we all think we're going to live forever. And so when you're put in that position in chemo, and the energy in there is phenomenal. I don't categorize it as good or bad, but it's like people that are experiencing this thing called existence in a way that I'm not, and I notice that. And so I spend time with my dad, and then my dad goes into hospice at the same time my wife asks me to leave. And I'm in that apartment with my friend Lindsay. And I am coming apart at the seams. And I am in the fetal position in her bedroom praying. Asking God to keep me safe and protected. I'm not asking him. I can't tell you the last time I asked God to keep me sober. The thought never occurs to me that I'm not going to be sober today or tomorrow. It just doesn't. It's been a long time. But I do seek refuge and sanctuary in my relationship with God. And God was bringing all those events to me. And that's the paradoxical nature of this thing called God. I'm a second step proposition guy, which is God is everything. So all those events that I described, that's God unfolding in my life. And then I'm seeking refuge in the very thing that's bringing all the experiences to me. And that, you know, chew on that for a little while. It's okay for me to live in that gray area because that's all the spiritual realm is. It's completely gray. There is no black and white in it. And I'm sitting there, and I'm in the fetal position, and I have tears coming down my face, and I'm just asking God to keep me safe and protected. And one of my spiritual teachers, I'm talking to him about it, and he's like, Tarek, let me ask you a question. What was the sincerity of your prayer like? And I said, it was probably the most sincere prayer I've ever said. He goes, that's beautiful. He's like, God is a merciful God, whatever God is. You'll be safe and protected. But he said, it is noteworthy that you notice the sincerity in your prayers. And then I started to reflect on all my prayer life. And I was like, you know, the struggles in life are create sincerity in my prayer life. And then struggle became sacred in a way. Because when I'm living in happy, joyous, and free, it's almost like they sell us a bad bill of goods here, right? Because we think if we're not happy, joyous, and free, that there's something wrong. Not the case. The fact is that we're human, and the heart is going to fluctuate. Life is going to fluctuate. It's a constant state of what I call variegation. We're being flipped back and forth. But that's the fact that our heart's broken over and over and always mends, that means something on the spiritual basis of life. It really does. It shows us that, A, we're not in control. And that's what also prayer acknowledges. Every time I pray, that's what I'm acknowledging. I am not in control. And so all those experiences that I had brought me closer in my awareness of God. But there are two things. I did them this morning when I got up to pray and meditate. Those two questions I ask myself every single morning that I engage in the practice of prayer and meditation before I start. Do I know why I'm about to pray and meditate? I'm not looking for an answer. I just want to investigate the question. Because when you investigate that question, it grounds you into the practice. The answers, what I notice in my consciousness, it changes all the time. But asking myself the question, why is this practice relevant to my life? Why am I engaging in it? What does it mean? Again, we're not looking for answers. It's just the question. First question, do I have knowledge of why I'm about to pray and meditate? Second question, is my heart present in what I'm about to do? Because the heart's presence is imperative if your prayer life is to be sincere. It has to be present. There is a man that I've been exposed to who says if you don't have knowledge and your heart's not present, the prayer is invalid. I don't know if I believe that or not, but I have thought about it. Every single morning when I engage that, it changes the way I experience meditation and prayer. And 10 and 11, and the way I've described them to you this morning, that is the juice in our program. That is the juice in the program. There is an abyss here for steps 10 and 11 and what you can do with them. My favorite passage in step 11 is be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they offer. It doesn't say they're always right, but it says be quick to see where they are right. There are so many teachers out there outside of just the big book and our recovery speakers, although they're amazing. It's endless. That's where curiosity has to come into play. And for me, I needed to investigate the world of the spirit, and that's the way I've done it. But the jewel of our program is this thing called sponsorship. There's an old tradition, it's an esoteric tradition that talks about the experience you have with the power of God can be, you can use the analogy of a fire. All right, so there is three things in this tradition. There's the lore of certainty. Lore is a story. It's a fable or a tale that people hear. Then there's the eye of certainty, where I see things. And then there's the truth of certainty, where I experience them. If we look at sponsorship, what I've noticed over the years, the experience, people's experience with sponsorship is drawn out into those three levels as well. There are those people who will experience sponsorship through the lore of certainty. All they hear is stories about other people's experience of taking people through the steps and working and sacrificing their personal time to show up and to give freely of what was given to them. So they only hear stories about it. Then there are other people that show up to your clubhouse or your AA group maybe 45 minutes before the meeting. And they sponsor when it's convenient for them, but their life does not depend on it, and that's okay, and they're welcome members of AA and CA and DAA. That's fine. But they don't suffer from what I suffer from. My illness requires me to sacrifice a great deal of my personal time to walk other people through this process. And so those individuals, they're witnessing it through other people's experience. So at my old home group, we had a bunch of classrooms before the auditorium. And every Thursday night, you get the meeting's at 7 o'clock. You get there at 5 o'clock. Every classroom is full with a sponsor and a sponsee. But there were people that came to that group. That was their only experience with sponsorship at that level. They would see it, but they were not engaging in it. And then you have those individuals. So if we're talking about this fire, you have the individuals who are consumed by the flames. And I'm a guy who caught the bug early on, was consumed by the flame of sponsorship. So I experienced the truth of that certainty that sponsorship is the jewel of our program. And because of that, I've had men in my life that I've sponsored for almost as long as I've been clean and sober that have become my teachers. We walk this path shoulder to shoulder. I have always been taught that structure when it comes to this process. And this jewel of sponsorship, it brings home this idea that the newcomers, they're not the most important people in the room. We tell them they are, but we have to inform them that it's only half true. If the newcomer is the lifeblood of our program, the blood has to have a heart to pump through. And that heart is those of us that are out there carrying the message of recovery in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And whoever said it this weekend, and I can't remember, we get this by giving it away. You will not get what I'm talking about unless you attempt to give it away. So it goes past this idea of just holding on to it as if we got something before we've engaged that part of the process. I hope I have given you a description of steps 10 and 11 and 12 that you will be able to carry away from here. But I'm going to end with a story, because this is the story of the type of mind that you want to bring into the spiritual dimensions of 10 and 11. There was a guy who was out hunting one day, and he's out in this nature preserve hunting. It's a beautiful day, and he stumbles across a dog, and this dog just starts hanging out with him. And then he's out by the lake, and he shoots a duck, and the duck lands in the water. This dog walks across the water, retrieves the duck, and brings it back to this guy. And his mind is just blown. He's just fascinated. He's like, man, this is wild. This is super cool. I'm going to see if he can do it again. And he shoots another duck. And this dog walks across the water, retrieves the duck, and brings it back to the hunter. This man is just beside himself. He's like, you got to come home with me. So he takes the dog home, and, you know, this is out, you know, by a lake, and he's got some neighbors, and one of his neighbors is sitting on the front porch drinking some beer, and he walks up to his neighbor. He's like, hey, man, let's go hunting tomorrow. And the neighbor's, like, thinking of reasons why he can't go hunting. He's like, come on, man, just do me a favor and come hunting with me. So the next morning they go hunting, and they're out there, and the hunter is not going to give away what is about to happen when he shoots this next duck. And so, you know, they're sitting there, you know, hiding, waiting for the ducks to come. And the duck comes, and the hunter shoots the duck, and it falls in the water. And this dog walks across the water and retrieves this duck and brings it back. The hunter looks over at the other guy. The other guy's just nursing his beer, you know, looking at his fingernails, you know, just passing the time. So hunter's like, okay, let's do this again. Next duck comes. Hunter shoots the duck. Duck falls on the water. The dog walks across the water and retrieves the duck. And the guy who's drinking his beer, just sitting there enjoying the day, doesn't notice it. The hunter finally turns to him. He's like, man, you notice anything funny about that dog? And the guy turns to him. He goes, man, the poor thing can't swim. You can take that mind into the spiritual dimensions of 10 and 11, or you can take the hunter's mind into the spiritual dimensions of 10 and 11. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Give him another hand. That was awesome. Okay. Thank you guys again for being here.